This is a University of Otago podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. I'll take into heart the term quality forum, so some of my comments will be aimed at, shall we say, improving quality rather than being negative about it. But first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the people who've helped me to do this. Brendan Vogt and Richard Gardner are two of our course supervisors, and Rodney Tamblyn is definitely our IT expert, and he's here today, and I'm pleased that he is, because if something goes wrong, I'll ask Rodney to fix it. I've given it the working title E for Eyes, and I think as we do better and I can afford a corporate car, I'll actually be able to put this on the registration. So it's a postgraduate diploma, and it's in ophthalmic basic sciences, and I should have taken the advice of the people on, never remember the name, Boggs, I think it is, who said, don't use ophthalmic BS. And I was, silly me, thought, no, that can't possibly be an issue, but we've since modified it to BSci. It doesn't sound as good if it's BS. It's essentially five 800-level papers, but they only need to sit four in order to get the diploma. Four of them are 13-week lecture programs, and they're each tailored to fit within a semester. And, of course, there are two semesters, as we all know, 14 weeks per year. Four of these papers are taught entirely on a distance platform. The fifth is a practical paper, which means they have to physically front up in Dunedin, or, as you'll learn shortly, could have an alternative opportunity to front up in Sydney and sit the practicum. But, of course, a number who don't live in New Zealand and don't even live in the Southern Hemisphere don't necessarily want to come to Dunedin for 3 weeks for a residential course. So that's why we have to make available four written papers if necessary. They get three assignments every semester at three weekly intervals, and they have to do a final written exam as well at the end of each semester. They're all medically qualified. As it's an 800-level paper, we assume that their 2 years as a house surgeon counts as an extra 2 years on top of their medical course. So they are, in effect, eighth-year student. The only criteria we impose is they have to be eligible for registration in their own country. They don't have to be registered. And as you can see, the majority of candidates don't live in Dunedin or even in New Zealand. Now, I was talking earlier to John, and I have to say immediately we serve two masters here. We serve the university, and we also serve the college. Our aim is to equip these guys with a qualification which will look so impressive on their CV that the college will immediately accept them into their training program. And I'll talk later as to how we allocate grades, etc., but we pretty much tell them if they only pass, they might as well not bother to apply for the college because they won't get on. They really either need a credit or preferably a distinction in order to get onto this. There are of the order of 160 candidates a year for of the order of 20 places. So it's a very competitive training program to get onto. And this is throughout Australia and New Zealand. And if they haven't got the top qualification, they may as well not bother. In the old days, it used to be that they sat a two-part exam. It was called the Part 1 Fellowship and the Part 2. The principle was they sat the Part 1 first, and then if they passed the Part 1, they were eligible to apply to the training scheme to sit the Part 2. The college came legally unstuck with that system because a number of people were saying, you've charged me, I've sat your exam, I've got your Part 1, now I demand the right to sit your Part 2. And, of course, the college said, well, sorry, there are only limited places for the Part 2, you can't get on. And they got into all sorts of litigation over that and finally scrapped it, and that was the moment when we picked it up and turned it into a standalone university diploma. And that's been the principle that we've adhered to throughout the process. And there are a number of doctors in New Zealand, currently non-ophthalmologists, there's one in Dunedin, a radiologist, who proudly affixes, amongst his other qualifications, the postgraduate diploma in ophthalmic basic sciences. It's of no value to him whatsoever, but there he is, a radiologist, and he's very proud of the fact he's got this diploma. So we try to make it available equitably so that all students get the same information at the same time or within the same time frame. We try to eliminate geographic disadvantage so that those who can't get their hands on, say, the Anatomy Museum in Dunedin can get the same information and material as if they did. And that's, I think, a little bit of what John was talking about before, the sort of high-tech stuff, which I'll show you shortly. And we always try to encourage interactivity, as indeed I'm pleased to hear that John does as well. You can't do this sort of stuff without it. Just to give you a rough idea of the sort of numbers, we began this on our own in 2001, and we had 12 students. I think three were New Zealanders, and nine were Australians. It may have been four and eight, I can't remember now, but there were certainly many more Australians. In 2003, University of Sydney said, well, we're going to do the same thing. How do you do yours? Sorry, Gary. And so he's sitting here like this, you know. So I said, well, look, by all means do it, and I'll help you as much as I can, but why don't we do it together? It makes much more sense. It's an Australasian college. Why don't we combine our resources and do it jointly? And that's exactly what we've done. We now have a joint badge, as it's called, a diploma, and it's the same material through each university. Of course, the New Zealanders enroll through Otago. The Australians enroll through Sydney. And internationals, we sort of scrap over a bit, but it's cheaper if they go through Australia. Our international fees are prohibitive. The Australian ones, they charge the same for domestic as they do for international, so it ends up being cheaper to do it through Sydney. In 2007, we'd had a combined total of 181 students who'd enrolled, and roughly, and I'm afraid I haven't got the exact figures because we've lost them, but roughly 25% were from it. That's about the ratio. It sometimes varies between a quarter and a third are New Zealanders. And of those, 121 have actually graduated. I just chose just to sort of give you a snapshot as to how we're going. These are semester one results. 18 passed, 16 got a credit, 8 got a distinction, and 4 failed. And curiously, when I was over in Sydney last week talking to the college, the very first question they asked me was how many failed, because it's of no relevance to them if it's a gimme. If they pass this exam automatically, it's of no purpose. They're just not interested in people who front up with a piece of paper that is of no consequence. They want to know this is a tough exam, meets their criteria, it's as bad as when they used to set it, and they were really tough. Only about 25% passed when that was their exam. But we've kind of got round that with our pass credit distinction. They had pass fail. We've got this sort of three-grade situation. So, in other words, most of their passes would have been a distinction with us or a credit. But a pass or a fail, of course, is of no value. There's the ratio. It's quite high at the moment, NZ to Australian, and there's one international as well. I mean, Australia's international, but you know what I mean. And this is something that I'm pleased that John has noticed as well. This is a conduit for masters, much more so in Australia. It's much more competitive again with this program in Australia, and frankly, without a master's, you won't even get a chance in Australia. New Zealand, you still will, but I'm pleased to say that we've now got 4 master's students in total. One was recruited from semester one, and prior to starting this course, and I'm sure Gareth will support me on this, clinical medical higher degrees are very rare. It's very unusual to get a guy with a clinical qualification who's practicing as a doctor to do a PhD or a master's. It's very unusual indeed. We'd only had one, and that was in 1980, prior to starting this course. We've now got 4. So it is, as you can see, a conduit to get into a master's program. The feedback, all the students who've fed back, I mean, of course, there was self-selection going on here, have been extremely positive thus far. Some, I have to say, did find the workload more than they expected. These guys are all working, and they're working in the traditional sense. They're house surgeons, and they're working every hour of the night or 80-hour weeks, or, you know, all the sort of stuff that you read about in the papers is real. They do. And so clearly scheduling teleconferences or the like with people who are working shifts and working weekends and, you know, sometimes sort of asleep on their feet is not necessarily a smart thing to do. So we haven't gone down that route, and I'll be pleased in a minute to invite Rob to tell us how they do, because I think it's a very useful modality, but it's one that we haven't decided to adopt. And there's huge variation in how much work they do. Normally they're supposed to do 20 hours a week. We've got this range from 5 to 30. And I suspect that five is probably, the very bottom end. I don't think anybody would survive this course if they just did 5 hours a week every week. And we did have some problems, as I'm sure you'd imagine, with this sort of high-tech stuff at the beginning, and they've been pretty much ironed out. Here are some of the specific comments. The assignments are too long. We give them 3,000-word assignments per semester. They're asking for more assignments, but they want them of shorter duration. And that's a fairly consistent request, too. The Internet Forum, which is marvellous, as you suggested, John, for encouraging interactivity, they actually either, it polarises them hugely, either love it or they hate it. We allocate a week, we'll say, okay, this is your week, you've got to talk on this particular topic, and the others can join in and make their presence felt. And the ones who get allocated that week, some of them will say, just can't wait, they're just longing to get on the keyboard there and make their views known. Others loathe it. They just don't want to be asked, and they just hate being involved. So it's quite strange how you do get that disparity. But most of them appreciate the forum. They learn a lot from it. And Rodney's now designed the forum so that it's actually a wiki. This is the first time we've used this wiki, but it will in time build up to obviously be a very valuable resource from now on. We also assign a mark for participation, and there's a number of those who don't want that. So we're going to review that situation. We, like John, use Blackboard. And the literature says it's a good choice. I think Otago have probably picked the best content management system that's available. But it didn't suit us for a number of reasons, and I'll go into that in a minute. We now prefer to use Ocean Browser. We use a combined DVD internet facility. So the students get their coursebook and all the course outline and stuff in that, but they also get a DVD. And on this DVD are a number of things which I'll be hopefully demonstrating in a minute. In order to use this thing, they must enroll. They must go online, and they must be given the access privileges. It's very user-friendly, as I hope you'll see in a minute, providing I can use it. It's also dedicated to this purpose. You're not having to go through a whole lot of channels to get to the one you want. It comes straight up as the application that you're looking for. It's secure because if they don't online, they don't enroll, they can't access it, or the access will stop after a period of time, and in our case it's a month. It also enables online annotation, so we can actually draw pictures of, and somebody at the other end can actually watch what we're drawing, or vice versa. We can change the content as we go, so if there's something wrong, we want to fix it up, we can fix it, and the student gets it as a sort of seamless change. And, of course, it enables VoIP, which I'm assuming is you're going to talk about in a minute, Rob, if you get a chance. VoIP is a great way to do teleconferencing. Disadvantages, well, obviously it's going to have bugs. There's still some bugs in it, but they're getting better. It's not cheap because obviously we're not. It's not paid for by Otago University. We can't expect to get it for nothing. And we don't know how vulnerable it is if Rodney got run over by a bus, etc. And we don't know how long it's going to be around. But right now, here and now, it serves our purpose extremely well, and I hope it will do for many years to come. Just going to the literature for a minute, and I think I generally agree with this. This is 2002, so things have moved on a bit, but I think in general they're not reflecting the principles of the learning paradigm. But it should also, in order to do this, it should meet the general requisites of an informal website, but it must incorporate the principles of new education philosophy through the appropriate use of multimedia. And that's where we really took our cue. You've got to use this thing. It's a tool. It's got tremendous virtues in this context, and you've got to use it. And it's not easy to use, and it's very expensive to use, but it certainly does work. The trouble is, these things take a lot of bandwidth, and to use that can often stop. Blackboard simply can't download the stuff in time. Students would talk about, I'd switch on the Blackboard, I'd go and start the download, and I'd go and make the tea, and by the time I got back, it might be ready to look at. Well, that's of no value whatsoever. If you start compressing your images, then you lose your quality, and of course, if it's the image that you're relying on to learn from, then that has a detrimental effect on the ability to learn it. But we've largely overcome this, as I said, the use of DVDs. We've gone off CDs, so they're just too small, and memory sticks. So we can actually get around a lot of that bandwidth issue by just supplying the stuff in a protected form on a disk. And, of course, as I said before, they have to have online access to get the privileges. I just want to talk briefly about reusable learning objects because it's a very important part of what we're trying to provide here. And this paper talked about the two important... These were proposing an interactive virtual medical school, which is not far removed from what we're trying to achieve, although in a very narrow field. It will be a curriculum map and a bank of reusable learning objects. And this is pretty much the way we've modelled our course as well. And again, just reinforcing that, it is, and I agree with this, poised to become the instructional technology of e-learning. I think it's using the medium appropriately. They're interactive, and in particular, in our case, optics, we can change the parameters, and I'll show you some examples of it. You can move the elements, you can change the rays, things that you cannot do in a book, and you never will be able to do in a book. Also, dissections, prosections, etc., things that you can't get easy access to in Wagga Wagga or Timaru, you can put them on the net in 3D form and people can look at them. Some scarce resources, and we've got some lovely examples of expanded skulls and stuff, which are so precious that people wouldn't even let you touch them, but we've got them photographed and able to be rotated and stuff, and you can see all the detail beautifully. So that sort of stuff is very well served by RLOs. As an example, here's a couple of pages out of a textbook illustrating this particular instrument. Now, you know, we all struggle with this, and I know exactly where the students have difficulty. So what I'm going to try and do now, and this is where I might need Rodney's help, is demonstrate how we do this with a... change it on me, Rodney. There. With a diagram which we can move. And the students get this thing. That's the same, illustrating the same diagram that you saw before, but what they can do with this is they can actually move it. And they can see the changes that take place. And if we do this one here, which is a combined observation and illumination position, then they can see the effects. They can stick lenses in. They can change the... Yeah, that's curious. Broken, Rodney. There we go. Right. Okay, so we can change the thing. And, of course, you've got a text to go with it as well. So the it makes it so much easier to follow the book. This is something that the books don't even do well. This little section here, and I don't want to bore you with the details, is something that you could read five texts and get five different explanations of. But we've got it here. It's just delightful when they see this. It immediately makes sense to them. They know exactly what we're referring to when this... It's curious that the handle's moving as well. Anyway, so... Who's holding their breath. I did this once before and the thing went completely pear-shaped, so I'm hoping that it's not going to do that today. They can also be used for clinical demonstrations without the need for patients. And this, is something that you've got. You've got to learn this stuff, and you can't always get willing volunteers, particularly for this kind of thing, to sit there while you practice your skills. It's a bit like surgery, but the trouble is that patients are usually anaesthetized when you're practicing your skills in surgery, so they don't usually know what's going on. But in this case, they're only locally anaesthetized. You try getting volunteers to put their hands up to let you practice doing this on them. But so at least they've seen how it's done beforehand, and they can then go away. And they've learned the principles, they know the physiology and the optics behind what they're doing, and they can... hopefully get it right when they do it on a real patient. And of course, they're accessible, as I said, the anatomy stuff. Actually, let's go into Ocean Browser now. It's 10 to 5. We've got plenty of time. Famous last words. So here we are. This is just looking at the forum. I think we're on the web, so we should be able to look into, have a peep into one of the forums, see what they're talking about. See if I can find a student. That's one of the secretaries there. So, they're all exam focused, as you can imagine. Probably shouldn't be doing this, but anyway. I'm sure there's a privacy law against it, but these people are actually active on the forum, and obviously this is a little bit. So this guy's basically going through some old papers here, and he said, you know, you need to know these ones. So. Anyway, let's not peek into their private conversations. Yes.
Just see how the words underlined as dots.
Yes.
Yeah. Those showing links
to the wiki. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone posts the word orbit anywhere in any discussion forum,
it'll come up.
Mm.
Thanks, Rodney. Yeah, the wiki's going to be a huge resource when it's sort of, you know, 2 or 3 years old. This is how they get into the forum. This is the VOIP. They can use the phone through their computer, or they can have a handset, etc., or a headset. And just go back to the content. This is for your benefit, Gareth. Just quickly run through the. So, in essence, this is what they'd see if they'd enrolled for anatomy. This is all they'd get. They wouldn't get the other stuff. They'd just get the one paper that they've enrolled for. And there are the various weeks laid out for them. So if we have a look at a good one to choose is week 6, because they're getting quite involved by then. So that now they get a series of, they get obviously the course outline. That just tells them what they can expect. To learn from this particular lecture. Now, the way we work it is we say, okay, there's 20 weeks, 20 hours in a week. The lecturers are told you've got 1 hour of lecturing each. So if you were standing in front of a group and you were going to give them a talk on this particular topic, what would you say in 1 hour? And it's not what you want them to read. They've read that. You can assume that they've read the books. And that's might be a great assumption, but it's a great privilege to teach people who've already read the books. You can say, okay, if you read chapter 3, you'll find the second paragraph is actually wrong. Don't worry about that paragraph, it's nonsense. This is what I think it should say. This particular section here, it's not very well explained in one book, but it's much better explained in the other book. Read that and you'll find a better description of it there. That's the sort of thing the lecturers are there to do. They sort of critique the literature. And they can, and usually correctly assume that the students have read it. So here's the required knowledge section. This is what they're meant to know by the time they're finished. And obviously it goes through the various bits and pieces that they're supposed to be familiar with. And then they get into the lectures themselves. And here, this is... I'll just give you a rough feel for what they're being given during the lectures. And that's... Move on to the. Just jumping down the page. There's quite a bit of content in that 1 week. And there are actually two lecturers involved with this. One guy does 2/3, and the other, this is the final guy doing the last third. And he's one of our stars. He's got some amazing stuff. There's a diagram, for instance, of the skull, and there's the dissection immediately below. So again, they can relate the diagram to the real thing. If we go on further down, we've got some of his movies in here. Now, if you take this particular piece of bone and you're looking at a picture in a book, That's great. I mean, you might well see all you want to see, but in this case, we can do more than that. We can actually have a look at it as it's rotated. And again, you cannot do that with a book, or you can't do it easily with a book. So there's an opportunity to learn more about this particular dissection or particular piece of bone from what's going. And this is full of this stuff. There's tons of it. Okay. So you know, I think that's right. I think it does allow the stuff to be accessible, and it does allow it to be easily updated. Now, we've used this information on this technology and some of the RLOs that we've developed to inform our undergraduate teaching. We now use some of these things that we've made for this course in a slightly simplified form, in most cases, to actually give to the students. And they love this. You give them a handout, and they think, oh, yeah, sure, you know, and they make paper darts out of it, or they scribble over it. Give them a CD. Oh, wow, that's great, you know. And they put it on their desktop, and they're so proud of it. And they actually do look at them. Because, I mean, we've got a thing called the EOP thermoscope, which we use to examine them. And they have to, it gives them there's about 500 cases in it, but they get 10. And they have to go through as if they were examining a patient using the mouse as an ophthalmoscope. And at the end of it all, they've answered all the questions, they get a five-letter code. And they've got to come back to me with the five-letter code to find out what their score was. So that and we know that because they come back, obviously, that they're using it. And most cases are using it very well. So that's how it sort of informs the undergraduate. But, of course, some of the stuff we've already made for the undergrads we actually put into the... And these are the four CDs that we used to provide. Now everything's on the one DVD, so it's even cheaper and simpler to do. So what are the advantages of a distance-based, internet-based distance learning course? Well, students can do it anyway. We had one guy who got posted to Vietnam, and he was able to continue from Vietnam, provided he could get on the internet, which, of course, he could occasionally do. You can cherry-pick. You can pick all the best lecturers from all over the world. We tend to use Australia and New Zealand, but there are others who we've involved from other parts of the world. You can just say to them, no, I want you to do a section on this, and there it is. You can travel. I mean, I've traveled, students have traveled, lecturers have traveled, obviously, and still be involved. You can still get on the forum, or you can still participate. The way we work the lectures is that the forum is the sort of first interface, if you like. There's a tutor for each topic. The tutor acts as a buffer to the lecturer. So if the students get it wrong, and John's absolutely right, the students can usually work it out for themselves if enough of them get involved. If they can't get it right, the tutor gets on. The tutor says, oh, no, you're wrong about this, and fixes it up for them. If the tutor's stuck, they're on the phone or they get on the internet to the lecturer who gave that particular part of the course. So you've got that sort of trickle-down effect.